This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been less than a week since the city began cracking down on operators who advertise illegal vacation rentals here on Oahu. A legal challenge will go before a judge at a hearing next week. It was filed on behalf of property owners who legally rent for 30 days at a time. Economist Paul Brubaker, who's with TZ Economics, has been watching the developments. He talked with us this morning. He's been asked by the Board of Realtors to talk to members in downtown East Honolulu, the Windward Side, and the North Shore.
The way I was brought up, my grandmother once told me, a farmer would never tell another farmer what to do with his land. And maybe nowadays I should say her land. But the point is, if we still have private property and believe in it, then, you know, there's a certain amount of elbow room you ought to tolerate among your neighbors because it's their house. But we do have boundaries and guardrails, and that's what, you know, some of these ordinances are supposed to provide.
Right. Now, you've been asked to go talk to the Board of Realtors in various areas around town. I'm just kind of curious. You did East Honolulu, I believe, last week. What kinds of questions did you get from the realtors?
As a consequence, their concerns are that they began to hear very recently, shortly after the passage of the ordinance, that investors wanted to dump their properties, weren't willing to take on the risk of the two things. One of the, you know, the fines. But the most important thing is that evidently a credible threat of enforcement. And we were just talking about boundaries and guardrails a second ago, and we have all these ordinances. Typically, we rely on the credibility of enforcement threats to induce compliance behavior, you know, a behavior that adheres to the intent and the principles underlying the rules that we design. But the reality is the city's resources, literally their fiscal resources, are taxed, no pun intended. I mean, they just don't have enough to do everything. And maybe we ask the jurisdictions to do too much. But the reality is, and very often, it's very difficult for them to actually effect enforcement and therefore create an environment in which the threat of enforcement is credible. And zoning is a perfect example of this. So there are numerous stories. You've told me stories about monster houses and people who build houses on ag land and all this stuff that's going on around. And, of course, for many years, vacation rentals. I mean, the irony of the 2019 vacation rental ordinance is that they were already, you know, quote-unquote illegal since an ordinance in 1989. But the threat of enforcement was not credible. And what's changed here is that in addition to, you know, the fines being more severe, they've built into the ordinance an enforcement mechanism that allows the Department of Planning and Permitting to utilize online advertising information from the hosting apps that have caused an explosion of this kind of use to occur, a subject we should come back to in a second. So it's because of the credibility of the enforcement threat that all of a sudden people managing portfolios of real estate assets, and that's a fancy way of saying everybody's auntie that owned a condo in Waikiki that was vacated, right? That's who the investors are in Hawaii. Everybody's auntie owns a condo. That's how we do rental housing in Hawaii. We don't have large, monolithic, apartment-owning, apartment-renting, you know, Kamehameha Schools doesn't own a bunch of apartment buildings. But that in the rest of the country, there's some wealthy landowner that owns apartment
buildings. What's auntie going to do? You think?
Well, that's what I'm saying. The realtors are telling me the auntie's selling the condo, or auntie's pulling her hair out because she's augmenting her Social Security. Yeah, I'm talking about our 85-year-old auntie that's had this condo for 3 years. And, right, she saved up her money, and then right before she retired from the state, right, she invested in this condo. And so she's been getting a rental income stream of $1,000, $1,500 a month. Above what she paid in the mortgage, and maybe by now it's paid off. But my point is she's augmenting her retirement income stream with this. I mean, this is a retirement investment.
So you believe it's a serious fear that's out there and that it may prompt people to sell properties that they would have held on to?
Well, this is another one of these disconnects where we make up this argument that it's all these offshore, evil, Darth Vader, Sith Lord investors from the mainland, you know, Holly guys from the mainland, or the one I love, Chinese investors. I'm like, what? Have you actually seen the data? And so, and of course, we don't want Sith Lords to be investing because they're from the mainland or they're from China. And it's a complete mythology because we invented the condominium in Honolulu so that small investors could participate in the real estate market. You don't have to own the whole building.
So you don't buy that most of the whole home rentals are investors?
It could be. I don't actually know. I'm just saying the democratization of the housing market happened a long time ago in Honolulu. And what hadn't happened is the democratization of the lodging industry. That's what the hosting apps did, right? They made it possible for anybody with a cottage in the back or an addition or a room in their house that they want to rent out to all of a sudden become the Hilton.
Yeah.
And
so,
to be the Hilton, you had to have 4,000 rooms at the Hilton Hawaiian Village to be a player.
So do you have any predictions? What do you forecast will happen as a result of this bill kicking in or the enforcement?
Well, as I say, the theoretical, so let's take the extreme case where everybody sells at the exact same moment, which is like this week. It's unlikely, but I'm saying, as I say, sort of the thought experiment is, so there's two extremes. One is whatever things were like last week, which whatever the values were last week, we'll look at the July or the June. Right now you can look at the June 2019, home sales data for the prices, blah, blah, blah. And it's going to be, $800,000 for a single family home, $450,000 for a condo. Those are the numbers. If that's one extreme, that it just stays like that and we just keep going our merry way. By the way, the equilibrium in this case, great article in the Sunday newspaper, but now I can't remember his name, Brill, I think, retired Honolulu Community College professor of science, wrote a great article about dynamic equilibrium. That's the path that we're on is the equilibrium. Right now it's 3% house price appreciation per year on the island of Oahu. So prices are actually moving, but that's an equilibrium trajectory. So whatever the forces are at work, whatever interest rates are, whatever investors are doing, that's the path. So that was the path in June. Worst case scenario is everybody sells at the same time, all of these vacation rental units, all the aunties, all the evil Sith Lord investors. And then you have, 7,000 additional housing units on an island where there's only 7,000 condos that transact each year. So all of a sudden they get dumped into the market. Prices instantaneously will decline, and we need to come back to that point. But you go to the path, you're already on an equilibrium path. You stay on that path in equilibrium because that's dictated by global capital market forces. But what you have is a discontinuity, a one-time step down. Now, I said I'd come back to this point. It's not just the condos in your building that are selling. Now your condo in the building, the value of that condo also goes down because of arbitrage. So everybody, in the worst case scenario, experiences to some degree or another, more in the beachfront neighborhoods.
Right, so the downward pressure.
Downward pressure on home prices. So that's a reduction in wealth. Somebody made you poorer, or something made you poorer. And I think the outcome is going to be somewhere between that catastrophic outcome and the no change outcome. There is going to be some change, and we're sort of all waiting to see, by how much it actually matters.
Right. Just anecdotally, I know the lawmaker, Senator Gil Riviere, was saying that, a few months ago he saw 1,400 units advertised on VRBO. That was down to 400 at the beginning of last week, and as of Friday, it was down to around 300.
So then the question would be, what's going to happen to those? What's happening right now as we speak to those 1,000 units? To what purpose are they being repositioned or redeployed as assets?
Right. Anything else that you think we should be looking out for?
I do think there's a broader context in which this is going on that we have to be careful about. So we've moved from a. You have to remember, there was a time in Hawaii from after World War II to about the mid-1970s. So there's a period for about 30 years where you basically could build anything you wanted. And so when I graduated from high school in 1973, there were 14,000 housing units per year, being approximately 13,000 some hundred. So let's say 13,000 housing units annually being authorized by building permit for construction. And the average from 1950 to 1974 was about 7,000 units per year. Today it's 2,500. So all the high-rise towers you see, it's the same as in the 1920s, the 2020s, we're going into the 2020s, we're building the same number of homes as we did in the 1920s with slide rules, with the difference that maybe we're building an additional 300, or we're like 300 higher than 100
years
ago. Well, that's a whole other question. Some people would say it is enough. I mean, the people who think that we shouldn't be building like we did from 1950 to 1975 are all happy. But my point is that we went from that world to a world where we were constraining development, right? We make it very challenging to get in, to acquire entitlement and, you know, have community input, all that stuff. And now we're in a different world. We're in the world where we dismantle productive capacity. So if you listen carefully, and it's not even between the lines, the governor has said for each telescope we build on Mauna Kea, we should dismantle five. That's new ground. That's like if you want to build 800 hotel units at Atlantis Ko'olina, you have to destroy 4,000 lodging. I mean, is that the logic? Because that's what he said about telescopes. Are we in a world now where you have to dismantle productive capacity in order to build productive capacity? I think not, except that he just said that. So who even contemplates that? These are long-lived assets, right? Houses last longer than humans. That's, you know, go to Detroit. Right. You can see what happens when things change and the houses are still standing.
Well, how long do you think before we actually see
The first thing we're going to see is the valuation effects, or not. But I think this other thing we're talking about now, this sort of in the context of the changing character of the host environment for investment, this is a much more insidious additional sort of signal that we're sending to the markets about, you know what, go away. We don't want your capital.
That was Paul Brubaker of TZ Economics. He sat down with us earlier this morning to share his thoughts as the city tries to crack down on illegal vacation rentals.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation supporting the Honolulu Museum of Art. The Summer 2019 Young Artist Exhibition showcases new works created during summer classes at the art school through this Friday. HonoluluMuseum.org.
The tourism industry in Hawaii is worth almost $17 billion. Visitors from China make up a pretty small portion of that, less than 2% of the state's 10 million annual visitors. But Chinese tourists spend more than those from any other location, and some policymakers are arguing that's exactly the kind of visitor Hawaii should be trying to attract. Glenn Mackay chairs a state Senate committee overseeing economic development and tourism. He spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about how Chinese visitors fit into Hawaii's tourism economy.
At the moment, they're not that important. They represent about 1.5% of our 10 million visitors, and actually, over the past year, has declined. So in 2016, we had 150,000 Chinese visitors. Last year, we saw that drop to 134,000. So we saw a 10% drop in Chinese visitors in the past 2 years.
And is there, do we have any idea why there that downward trend is the case?
One can kind of point to just what's going on the federal level. I don't think Trump is winning a lot of Chinese favor with his trade policies. And we have this longstanding problem in America of visa requirements. So a Chinese person could have an assortment of other destinations to choose from. Why have to go to the U.S. Embassy to get a visa to come to America? So a lot of Chinese are choosing to go elsewhere in their travel decisions.
So the trade dispute is perhaps contributing to the downward trajectory, but not the sole cause of.
Oh, no, not the sole cause. I think the bigger issue is that visa requirements. If we could ever get to having a visa waiver program with China, then you will see throughout America a higher influx of Chinese visitors.
How do Chinese visitors compare to Americans or visitors from other countries in terms of per visitor spending? Because I know that's one of the metrics that's always cited as being very important.
Yes, and then, you know, that's something that we really are looking at locally because of the pushback from the local community that, you know, 10 million might be the tipping point and that we should pivot away from marketing and look more at the management side of tourism. We want to have the same economic, if not larger economic impact with less of the human impact. So we've kind of legislatively conveyed to the Hawaii Tourism Authority, take your foot off the gas for marketing a bit and really focus on cultural and environmental enhancement. And in doing that, who and what are the markets that we should be looking at? And the Chinese market, albeit right now is relatively small for the state of Hawaii, has the best potential because you find that the Chinese visitors spend more. They spend about $352 a day compared to the Japanese and Korean visitors. Japanese will spend about $250 a day. So they're big spenders, and they stay longer here. The statistics from HTA show that a Chinese visitor here will spend upwards of 7 days here. By comparison, a Japanese visitor will spend 6 days here. And what's also interesting about the Chinese market is they don't just travel in couples. Generally, they travel with their families. So the impact is much larger with the Chinese population. We just have to perhaps wait out what's going on in the federal level and at the right at an appropriate time, really push to try and grow our Chinese market presence here in the state of Hawaii.
Are there any initiatives that are being undertaken to expand the numbers of Chinese visitors coming?
I don't think that we're there yet. I mean, there's no sense in us spending a heck of a lot of marketing dollars or redoing signage in Waikiki or tourist areas if the Chinese are not here. So I think I was conveying to the Hawaii Tourism Authority, we just kind of take a wait-and-see attitude, see if Trump changes his ways or Trump is no longer our president, and see what on the federal level, what changes can be done there. There's really no sense on a statewide level for us to pour a lot of resources into the Chinese market yet. When that day comes and things change on the national level, I think that's when we need to really open up our opportunities and have more marketing funds flow into China.
What are some of the long-term investments or changes that Hawaii or Hawaii businesses might need to make to appeal to the Chinese market? I noticed just recently that you're seeing more businesses take China UnionPay the way JCB started being accepted at a lot of local retailers 20 years ago.
Oh, sure. Anything that's going to make the ease of commerce better and make them feel more comfortable here, so inclusive of changing signage, having staff that speaks Chinese, offering maybe more of Chinese dishes at restaurants, we really should be prepared when that day comes on the federal level to just lay out the beach mat for the Chinese visitors.
To be a fertile environment to cultivate more tourism,
yes,
for them.
Yes, exactly.
Do we have any idea why the numbers coming from China are so much lower than, say, Japan?
Well, Japan is a mature market. Hawaii's been cultivating that market for 40 years, and we've just, I would say less than 10 years, have kind of tried to cultivate the Chinese market. But again, it really is due to that visa restriction that is still hanging over the Chinese.
How much does the maturity or the maturing of the Chinese economy come into play? Because they now have a very well-established middle class. Travel is becoming much more of a normal thing for regular Chinese citizens, perhaps, than it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing that the Chinese have an appetite to travel. Statistics show that last year, 160 million Chinese traveled abroad. How many did the U.S. capture? About 3 million. So you can see this is not just a Hawaii issue. They just are choosing not to, for a multitude of reasons, not to come to America. And when they do, I think Hawaii should be positioned quite well to capture that market. But the Chinese are maturing. They're seeing the world. They finally have the financial ability to see beyond their borders and are certainly exploring the world. America just is not, at this point, capturing the economic benefits of that exploration.
What have you been hearing from constituents, from businesses and managers in the community about how this, some of these impediments at the federal level, whether the visas or the trade war, how it's affecting their businesses as it comes to either buying or selling to China?
I don't hear a lot from the tourism industry. In my swim lane at the Capitol, I take care of energy. I hear a lot more from the guys in the energy space as to how solar panels, wind turbines are getting more expensive because a lot of that steel comes out of China. But to be honest, in the tourism sector, I haven't heard a lot of folks really paying attention to the value of the Chinese market.
Reflective of the fact that Chinese visitors are a relatively small portion of Hawaii's visitor economy.
That's correct. But I think has very huge upsides if we time our marketing correctly.
And so it's reasonable then to expect that because the tourism industry is the dominant economic driver of Hawaii's economy, that this trade war maybe won't have such significant negative impacts here as it might in a place where manufacturing or shipping is more important to the local economy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if Hawaii was a manufacturing state, we would be devastated by what is going on the national level. It's kind of interesting, right, that tourism is such a fickle and volatile industry. Natural disasters, man-made disasters dramatically and instantaneously affect the numbers of tourists that we have coming here. But manufacturing generally is a stable economic driver, and people don't just at a flip of a switch stop buying cars, stop buying corn. There's a long runway. So in this particular case, I think Hawaii is blessed that what's going on nationally, albeit detrimental to the U.S. economy with the trade war with China, isn't having a huge effect locally because of the fact that the Chinese are currently not a huge factor in our tourism base.
When it comes to the idea you mentioned earlier about cultivating a tourist who maybe stays longer, spends more money, and kind of contributes more financially to economic output here, and that being potentially a Chinese visitor, how do we bring them in without just increasing the total number of people? So if we attract an additional 1 million Chinese visitors a year, how do we make the switch from just going to 11 million? You know, how does that play out?
I think you're already seeing it on the local level. Just the fact that the city finally, city of Honolulu finally got guardrails around short-term vacation rentals, that in itself will drive down the number of visitors that are coming here, which I think is good because we don't need to have 11 million cheap, frugal visitors here. I think if we have 9.5 million, larger portion of them being Chinese visitors, we're going to see the same economic benefits for the state with fewer human impacts on the state.
So a substitution, so say.
Yes. Swapping out one cheap visitor for one free spending visitor.
Well, Senator Glenn Wakai, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Ryan.
That was Senator Glenn Wakai talking to HBR's Ryan Finnerty about the impacts of tariffs and Chinese tourism affecting Hawaii's economy. We'll have links to more data on the state's visitor industry at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Airlines, celebrating 90 years, offering nonstop service with seat selection to 13 North American cities, now including Boston. Reservations at hawaiianairlines.com.
I'm David Folkenflik. Coming up on the next On Point, best-selling crime novelist Laura Lippman is here to navigate her new novel, Lady in the Lake. It's about race, class, and newspapers, and it's set in her hometown of Baltimore. That's coming up in the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, right after The World.
Our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat spotlights a two-year legal battle to get access to names of law enforcement officers. Political and opinion editor Chad Blair joins us on the line this morning. Hi there.
Good morning, Catherine.
So this is your big data dive.
Yeah, you know, Civil Beat's been around, and I've been around since the beginning, since 2010. And when we first published our database of public employee salaries, boy, the traffic just went through the roof. People wanted to know how much people were making. And we didn't do it just for hits, for, you know, to get eyeballs to the site, although that in part was the reason. But the more important reason is this is taxpayer money, and that the budgets, the salaries, are a major part of what the state and county has to account for, and these are taxpayer dollars. So we feel very important, very importantly, that this needs to be made public as easy as possible. And today, I'm happy to say we have our latest database up on the site, and this one, as you indicated, is about HPD, Honolulu Police Department, although you're right, we did have some trouble getting the data from them.
Right. Your article says that the city actually tried to provide the information, but the union blocked it.
Yeah, that's SHOPO. I should say that every other agency, pretty much, that we've been getting salaries from, and you can imagine they're just all over the state and counties, pretty good about turning over the information promptly, recognizing that it's public interest. Not so with the HPD info. 2 years ago, SHOPO challenged that legally. They argued in particular that they were worried about the identities of undercover police officers being made public. And in fact, there is an exemption in the state's public record law for undercover cops. But the question came down to what exactly defines an undercover police officer? What identifies one as a plainclothes officer? At what point are they still undercover if they later go to work in a different part of the department? So that held up the release of the data for the last 2 years, and now SHOPO's court appeals have run out, and a judge has followed through saying, look, this is public information. It's of public interest for people to know, and so that data is now up on the website with some exceptions. There's about 114 names that are withheld, some inspectors in the Attorney General's office, Commerce and Consumer Affairs, and also public safety. We're still trying to find out exactly how it is that they were able to exempt those particular names.
Yeah, I mean, I can see, you know, you do want to protect those officers that are deep undercover,
right,
and trying to get information that we need to get these criminals off the street. But yeah, how broad is it, that definition? And interesting that it includes all those other departments.
Yeah, exactly. And SHOPO has said their main concern is public safety, that somehow you might harm someone if their name were to get out there. And by the way, we should say that the specific numbers on some salaries are not known. The state actually allows you to provide a salary range, you know, like 50,000 to 100 and so forth. But there are some people at the very top of the police department whose exact salaries we know. That includes Susan Ballard, the chief. She makes the most, no surprise there, $205,000 annually. And then two deputy chiefs under her at 196. And the way this works, it's really simple to use. You go on our website, civilbeat.org, and the name, the title, and the salary are available, and you can search. There are a total of 2,000, more than 2,000 people employed with HPD.
Okay, and so what do we have to look forward to down the road? So HPD today, and then what else?
Yeah, I don't have the next one in line, but I can tell you every time there's a new fiscal year and there's been a change, maybe with particularly with contractual obligations, salary increases generally go into effect after negotiations. So I don't know the next batch, but I can tell you that we will be churning these out over the next few weeks. And I got to give SHOPO some credit. Brian Black of the Civil Beat Law Center, which was handling the lawsuit over this information, he actually credited new leadership at HPD for making this information available. But sure enough, you can bet we will be getting the salaries of such as the state legislature, the Honolulu Mayor's Administration Council, the county councils, and so forth, all information regarding public employees in the state of Hawaii.
And that covers University of Hawaii too, right?
Yes, it does. In fact, I was actually looking back to one of the first ones we ever ran back in 2010 again, and we ran the lowest paid and the highest paid UH salaries. And I remember at the time we got some calls, mostly from people angry to find out that they were making less than their coworker, but others grateful to say, I appreciate knowing this information. It is public. And ever since then, it has been, as I said earlier, we really consider it a public service. This is your money. You should be able to know how it's spent.
Yes, and I know for years we've always heard that university jobs are plum jobs, and that's where folks believe that, you know, that's where lawmakers or, political hacks, I don't know how you want to describe them, but a lot of them end up at the university with much higher salaries.
Yeah, and I can tell you that's always been a point of contention, particularly to some lawmakers who say, why are you paying them so much? In the defense of the UH, real quickly, they say you got to be competitive with universities across the country.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Chad.
Sure, Catherine.
That was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. If you want to find out more on this issue, visit civilbeat.org. Mauna Kea, what makes it sacred? That's a question some have been posing as the controversy over the 30-meter telescope rages. HPR's Ku'uwe Hiraishi joins us live. Morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. So this idea of sacredness is really at the root of the argument being pushed by those calling themselves Kia'i or protectors of Mauna Kea, right? The reason for blocking the 30-meter telescope construction is because of the sacredness of Mauna Kea. And I think Taika Vikatengan, our anthropology professor and chair of the Ethnic Studies Department up at UH Manoa, really kind of summarizes the idea or the Hawaiian sort of point of view when it comes to things being sacred.
This is not a matter of Hawaiian notions of what is sacred versus science. Much of what we understand as kapu is related directly to our indigenous scientific way of understanding the world and understanding that our akua, our gods, are in the world, in their natural formations. And to designate something as kapu or set aside is also to understand the life cycles of the world that need to be protected in order for us to perpetuate life and ea of this land.
So I think in its broadest form, Native Hawaiians see the sacred in all forms of nature, right? We have seen it from the mountains to the ocean. Everything sort of has a sacred aspect to it, or we've got aumakua and akua that we see in these. But specifically with Mauna Kea, so going back to a genealogical chant that was composed for Kamehameha III, Kaui Keoli, in it, actually, it specifically says that Mauna Kea is the mountain, is the firstborn couple, firstborn child of Wakea, or Father Sky. So when they talk about this connection of Mauna Kea being the pico or the umbilical cord that connects people to Wakea and to the gods, that's what they're talking about. And I should say, not all Native Hawaiians subscribe to this belief, or perhaps they subscribe to the belief, but may be more willing to compromise on, you know, having this idea of sacredness integrated with new science. But for those that are up on the Mauna, this is sort of at the heart of what they're trying to protect. And in some Hawaiian sites, though, so. There are ones that are typically given more mana or more sort of sacredness because of the continued religious practice of worshiping at these sites. So heiaus would be a good example. This is a place where Native Hawaiians would constantly go to worship. And there were sites like this up on Mauna Kea that people have done for years. And one family that has a special connection, I got to speak to Uncle Paul Nevis. He is a Kea, so his family's name is actually Kea, and he explains what he's heard through his mom about what the mountain means to their family.
My mom is Agnes Kea. She is a Kea, and she always talked about our relationship to the Mauna, most beautiful mountain in the world. So, Ma, what does that mean? So, well, we're Kea people, unblemished, the mountain without blemish. It's so holy, you're not supposed to go there, and if you're supposed to go there, it's for something really important. Mm. You walk very softly. You leave no footprints. Your footprints will be taken away. Yeah, that's how she explained it.
So Nevis was part of one of the cases that was brought up against the emergency proclamation, and you know, was able to go up to Mauna Kea through the blockade to worship and to sort of have his time on Mauna Kea. And trying to think about, for those who are closely connected, whose families have been going to Mauna Kea for various reasons, there's also folks who will take their piko or the umbilical cord up to Mauna Kea and bury it so that it can be kept safe from any sort of bad omens and bad vibes. But he talks about how important it is, Nevis does, to protect this ability to access Mauna Kea and to keep it being sacred.
We do anything to continue our connection with Mauna Kea. We have to do everything. If it's a court case fight, if it's breaking a blockade fight, if it's going up Mauna Road behind them and go pray, fine. Whatever we do, this is our religious right.
So are there degrees of sacredness?
I think, so from my understanding, and like I said, in the broadest form, you see sacredness in all forms of nature. But there are areas or sites that have been worshipped for so long and have been sort of, it's called ho'omana, which is the Hawaiian word for religion, is actually when you sort of put mana and empower these places with that sort of, that ability to worship Wakea and Papa and Poliahu, the god, snow goddess, up on Mauna Kea is something that gives that area more mana, more power.
Okay, because I know the Pacific Island culture that I grew up in with Guam, the Chamorros, we have a thing where if you go, before you go in the forest, you have to ask permission from your ancestors.
Right. Right. That's the same protocol that is taken up on Mauna Kea and various sites. And just that idea of needing to respect nature in a certain way, I think, is really at the heart of this argument. But in talking about desecration, so this idea that, you know, the building of the telescope will have an impact on the overall sacredness of Mauna Kea, I think that's a point of contention for a lot of folks. You know, our environmental impact statements for the 30-meter telescope have listed different cultural sites and historical sites, and say TMT site will be, you know, off to the side and won't be impacting these particular sites. And I think Kamali Kuwata, a Hawaiian studies professor up at Manoa, really kind of gets to the heart of what desecration, I think, looks like within the context of this TMT debate.
To me, the desecration really comes from disallowing Kanaka to have their beliefs about this place and having to prove that it's an important place to us. You know, like we have to have all of these things where any structures on the Mauna have to be, you know, 300 years old. They can't have been built new because we're not a living people. You know, the things that we do now and decide now can't have bearing on the world now. It all has to be, you know, stuff of us as of the past.
It was an interesting point, I thought, in speaking with him, but I think is really maybe what we're seeing up on Mauna Kea is that idea of families and generations wanting to perpetuate that sacredness and wanting to practice up on the mountain again.
Well, and I understand, and I correct if I'm wrong, but did UH President David Lassner make some statement that he didn't believe Mauna Kea was sacred?
He did in an interview with Mahalani Richards, and I think he was asked whether or not he thought it was sacred, and he ended up sort of explaining himself out that no, he didn't. And I think that discussion, having that discussion between folks who are working on the project and pushing the project and these Native Hawaiians who believe that it's sacred, that discussion is probably something that should be happening sometime soon.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much. That was HPR's Ku'u Wehiri. She with What is Sacred? You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence on your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe that surrounds our tiny planet, and also things we can try and spot in our dark skies. We are thankful to have astronomer Christopher Phillips joining us, and we've got him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have in store for us this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be here. This week, stargazers look out for Jupiter and Saturn in the southwestern sky just after 8 p.m. Both planets are bright and easy to spot. The moon this week is passing through its first quarter phase, bringing a picturesque celestial presence to our night skies.
And you have news about some new planetary discoveries?
Yes, planets everywhere. NASA's Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS, has been working in conjunction with some ground-based observatories to confirm the existence of several new exoplanets around a bright red dwarf star, 31 light-years from the Earth. This newly discovered family of planets is a diverse bunch indeed.
Ah, what do you have in this batch?
Well, the innermost planet is roughly 22% more massive than the Earth, and it orbits very close to its star. So close, in fact, that the surface temperature is estimated to be around 490 degrees Fahrenheit. Very toasty indeed. The second nearest planet is a giant version of our own Earth, with a year that lasts 9 days. And the third is, again, planet much larger than our own Earth, but interestingly, it lies in the star's habitable zone.
Ah, the Goldilocks zone, right, Christopher?
Indeed. And we call it the Goldilocks zone because it's a region of space where it's not too cold and not too hot. It's just right, and a place where essentially we might find liquid water. The Earth sits in the habitable zone of our own sun, while Venus and Mars lie at the outer edges.
So what you're saying is there may be some life.
Potentially, yes. But right now, we don't have any direct evidence to suggest that that's the case. We don't even know if this planet has an atmosphere, let alone a rocky surface capable of supporting liquid water. But hopefully, very soon, we'll have more evidence to find out exactly what's going on there.
And I know somebody who's going to have that for us. That would be you, Christopher Phillips.
Indeed.
And right here on Stargazer. Thank you, brother.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And you can get Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Culinary Institute of the Pacific, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
State forestry officials put the alert out about the discovery of a dreaded disease, rapid ohia death, in a tree above the Pearl City area last week. A team with access to the Kamehameha School's property in Waiau plans to take the diseased tree down today. It will continue to survey the immediate area to see if it had spread anywhere else. Rob Hauf is a forester with the Department of Land and Natural Resources who talked to us about the discovery for our Garden and Forest segment.
It was sad news, of course, to get a detection here on Oahu. Fortunately, it's the less aggressive disease, but it is still something that can kill ohia trees and can be a problem. So we're treating it very seriously.
So this is a head scratcher because this is an area that's kind of remote, right?
That's correct. This is not an area where a lot of people would be going to. It's near the summit of the Ko'olau's. It's quite a ways from the trail. However, it's possible that it got there through wind dispersal. The experts are still working on finding out how the disease is moving around, and wind dispersal for this site definitely seems like the most likely explanation.
Does it cover a large area?
So far, we've only detected one tree, and in the immediate area, there were a couple other trees that need to be checked out, but not a lot of dead trees in that area. However, on the other side of the ridge, there is a good-sized area with dead trees that we need to get into and sample. This is all on the leeward side of the Ko'olau's, on state land, so in Waimano Valley. So there is a watershed protection project that is scheduled to occur up there. This isn't exactly in that area. It's on a very steep slope. It's not an area where they've been working. So it's unlikely that the workers were the vector for it because of the location of the tree that tested positive.
Okay, so a bit of a head scratcher. So yeah. How did we detect it? Did something look off up there? And
So there were crews who were out doing, this is with the Ko'olau Mountain Watershed Partnership. They were doing their forest protection work, and they spotted it from afar and decided that it was probably a good idea to go take a sample.
The only fast-growing strain then is what, on the Big Island and a little bit on Kauai?
That's correct.
Okay, and have we been able to keep the one on Kauai in check?
Yes, so far we've not had any other detections outside that immediate area.
And describe that area.
Okay, so that's also in kind of a remote area and a bit of a head-scratcher of how the disease got in there. And they've been doing surveys in the area around as well as around the entire island. And so far they haven't found the aggressive species in an area outside. They're trying to still delimit it within the area that's infested so that they can get a better idea of where they need to contain it to. There's still some outlying areas. It's very rugged, and so it's difficult for crews to get in easily and sample. It can be a full day just getting to one tree.
And do you think there could be another carrier aside from the wind? Could it be birds?
It's unlikely that it's birds. Going island to island, I think that when it's detected in a remote area, wind is probably the most likely. The people certainly could be vectoring it, but it hasn't been the case. It hasn't been the likely explanation in the area where we've seen it. So, wind seems to be the most likely vector in this case.
If it's wind,
mm-hmm.
It's not a good thing if we're in hurricane season and we've got storms on our doorstep.
Yes, that is correct. So the next objective will be to do further intensive surveys to determine whether, are there more trees in this area? Has it been there a long time? Are there other trees on the island and other watersheds that have it too? So far, over the past few years, we've taken 150 samples and we haven't found it. But we do need to step up our surveys and get a better idea of the extent of it on the island. When they found this species on Kauai and did more intensive surveys, they actually found it in several different locations on the island, which indicated that it had probably been there longer than they had originally expected.
Interesting. And so if it's in the rainforest, and I imagine that the disease thrives in wet areas?
Yes, it does seem to like wet, moist forests more than the drier forests.
What about in New Zealand? Because they have a similar ohia-looking tree.
That's correct. It's in the same genus, Metrosideros. So they're very concerned about this. They have actually sent seeds, I believe, to the lab in Hilo so that they can conduct inoculations with the disease in Hawaii to determine whether it's susceptible to the same disease or not. And I don't know, I don't think that the results have come out on that study yet, but it certainly is a concern for them and other places in the Pacific that have Metrosideros species.
So when did the studies begin? Just this year?
On the New Zealand?
Yes.
I think that they had sent material a while ago, but they have to grow it out till it's large enough to actually do the inoculations. And so I'm not sure what the schedule is for actually doing the tests. And that would be USDA Agriculture Research Service, who does all of the diagnostics for rapid ohia death.
Okay, but so far they haven't found anything yet.
So far, they haven't found any other species than Metrosideros polymorpha to be infected.
And do we know where this rapid ohia disease came from?
We don't. It is unique. It's related to these groups of diseases that it's very similar to, but we do not know where it came from exactly.
So big mystery.
Yeah.
Where did it come from? And how is it spread?
Yeah, exactly. There are five main things we're asking people not to do across the state. Don't move ohia wood or plant material from areas that are known to have rod. Don't transport ohia inter-island. Clean your tools and your gear whenever you go into the forest. Use 70% isopropyl alcohol to clean the soles of your boots. and wash your vehicles as well if you've been driving off-road into the forest. And finally, don't wound ohia trees. This disease needs a wound in order to infect a tree. So if you have an ohia tree, avoid wounding it so that there isn't a pathway there for the pathogen to infect it.
That was DLNR State Forester Rob Hoff talking about the discovery of rapid ohia death in a tree in central Oahu.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Paiko, located in Kaka'ako, a botanical boutique with fresh local flowers, plants, and workshops celebrating Hawaii's nature, now offering delivery. PaikoHawaii.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Terry talks to filmmaker Rodney Evans. He's lost much of his vision, but he's still making movies. His new documentary, Vision Portraits, is about how he and three other blind or visually impaired artists, a writer, a dancer, and a photographer, continue to do their work. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3, right after On Point.
We are all out of time, so we have to go. But up tomorrow, we'll keep an eye on the vacation rental crackdown, and we would like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. So are you renting or were planning to come to Honolulu? Let us know. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, go to our Conversation page. Look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.